telling people, hey, revolution rising. Yeah, yeah. Proof. Yes. Watch out. Yeah. Giving us the run around.
Fellow Trini by way of Britain, Anthony Joseph on vocals, and the music is composed by modern music composer and worldwide DJ Andrea Benigni, better known as Mop Mop, and we heard from Fred Wesley. The name should sound familiar if you're a James Brown fan. Fred was part of James Brown's slamming horn section. This is titled The Runaround, and it is from Mop Mop's 2013 release titled Isle of Magic. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it is Free Your Mind Friday. So you are invited to free your mind. We had a very awful week, and it opened our eyes to quite a few things. And I'm hoping that you have further commentary on that. But we'll see where you want to take the conversation. That's the whole point of Free Your Mind Friday. It's an unscripted open forum. And you take the conversation wherever you want it to go. Hopefully, there'll be people reacting to what you say. So, from New Jersey, we start with Bill. Hello, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Yes. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Good. I'd like to speak on this whole idea that Donald Trump is responsible for these shootings been taking place. That idea, I think, just doesn't hold water. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. Yes, Donald Trump is a racist. Yes, Donald Trump says inflammatory remarks. But this country was killing brown people its entire history. Trump did not make America racist. Racist America made Trump racist. Racist America created Trump, not the other way around. And killing brown people is not anything new for this country. And when people say this isn't who we are, it absolutely is who this country is. I'm not going to say we, but it's who this country is. Torturing, killing brown people is something this country has always done here and all around the world. So I don't see it. And if it is the president's fault for the shootings that go on, well, shootings really picked up in earnest during Barack Obama's 8 years. And I didn't hear anyone blaming Barack Obama for the shootings. And Barack Obama did nothing that I know of to stem that tide of shootings other than make appearances and say this is bad. But did he do anything about it? Not a thing. And as far as people that say that we made a mistake making Trump president, yes, absolutely, we made a mistake. Or I didn't make the mistake. I didn't vote for him. Making Trump president, but there were various mistakes made with every president before him. And in this particular election, the last election, the choice was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. And I put the question out to the PRN family, if you can think of one thing that would be better if Hillary Clinton was president, I certainly would like to know about it, as I can't think of a single thing, any way that we would be better off if Hillary Clinton was president than Donald Trump.
But you're conflating many different arguments as if they kind of streamline, but they don't.
Well, the choice was Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. On my last point, that was the choice. So what I'm saying is, in that choice, I don't know that the wrong choice was made. The problem is not having a choice.
What I'm raising with you is that I'm not clear now. What is your argument?
On which point? On a choice between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
You're conflating several issues into one thing. And you're saying essentially that you don't see how Trump could be blamed for these racially motivated slaughters. You just don't see that.
I don't see it, because that has been taking place in this country its entire history.
Yes, but this is a specific instance. These are specific instances, and they happen to be quite significant, and they are happening, and they have happened in our time. So to say, well, we reach back and say, this is nothing new. We already made that point.
It's not.
Yeah, but we made that point already.
So
what he's saying is, I'm asking you, how could you now make the leap and say that people are wrong to link Donald Trump to these killings?
The reason I'm saying that is, if something predates, you can't say that there's a causal relationship. Let me make my point. You can't say that B comes from A if B preceded A.
Yes, but
if
you're
B
making a non-argument, because the one has a relationship to the other insofar as the crimes and the enormity of the crimes, sure. The kind of crime, yes. But we still have two entirely different time periods in which they are occurring, and there is a clear case that should be made, or could be made, that Donald Trump's rhetoric, unchecked rhetoric, racist rhetoric, might have inspired people to stage these mass killings. I don't see that there is an incongruence there. I don't see that at all. They're two separate things. The points made at each time were relevant, as they are now with Donald Trump coming into power and making a point of dividing the nation and invigorating people who are inclined to resurrect the old days, as they would say, of lynchings and racially motivated attacks. There's clearly a case that could be made there to connect Trump's invective and the actions of some individuals who might have taken their cues from him. He can't escape it. Thanks for getting us started, Bill. Moki from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Greetings and salutations. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, I can.
That's great. How are you today, you three?
Fine, thank you, Moki. What's your What's your presentation today?
Well, just an introduction today. I've been feeling the sore need for community on a very personal level for a long time before the discussion started to gel around it on the program. And so I guess I'm alerting everyone that I'm going to outline, starting with defining what a community should be. And I'm speaking about a physical community, because I don't believe an online community or a community of some loose...
Okay, we're getting some interference. Could you speak directly into your mouthpiece, your phone, or whatever you're using?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Based on a model, I will just, for now, refer to the, before the arrival of European white men, the Iroquois Nation, which was a federation, was operating pretty well. I think that the average community was a village of 50 people. But they traded in emergencies. They coalesced their energies. So working off that, I'm thinking people have to dust off their shortwave radios. So that would be reviving the shortwave club, radio club. I'm thinking of extreme to very extreme, a range of extreme to very extreme scenarios. So, the main focus is I'm thinking, what does a community of 50 people, one tribe, and I'll call it a tribe, would have a certain service or profession, which another tribe might not. So there's the inter-cooperation there. As far as...
Well, let me stop you for a minute. I'm troubled by this number 50. Where did that come from?
I don't know.
Okay, that's the first problem.
One of the PRN programs.
The history of the First Nations and the first people of this nation is very often wrong. But just the same, we adopt a wrong history. They were not tribes. They called themselves bands, but they were not tribes. These were established groups of people. In fact, numbering, if you would take into consideration that they were spread all over the continent of the United States, in the millions.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't just a group of, about 12 or a dozen or three dozen people, huddled together. No. They were very much evolved. In fact, the Constitution of the United States derives from their Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
The system they worked to govern themselves and to work out treaties with each other and so forth. So we have a very distorted view of the first people, the First Nations. And we ought to understand that that was deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
The people who write the history of the United States, in every instance, did everything possible to show how inferior the people who they met here were, and therefore deserved, there should be no love lost, that they were wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
So, because they weren't even human, according to the people who came here and did all manner of evil and torture to them, to literally wipe them out. But they had systems of survival. And that's why they're still around. Nothing like the original, but in any event, they have survived. They still are surviving by their own systems. And we have to be careful when we start talking about them from the point of view of racist white supremacist history.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, when it comes to the first people here, the history is almost always wrong, badly wrong.
Mm. Despite my misconceptions, I think I'm going in the right direction, especially when you point out that we have modern, current models. So out near the Standing Rock and surrounding area, the First Nations, what's left of the First Nations peoples there, are going off the grid as soon as possible. They're trying to become independent communities. So where I pulled the 50, I think it would just be what someone considered a manageable group, short of any kind of infrastructure. Things break down enough, and we don't have power. That's why I mentioned shortwave radios. There are people, individuals who have generators and towers and can communicate if all else fails. So despite my misconceptions, I think a confederation or a federation, I'll say, I'm sorry, a federation of people determined to survive. So I don't want to get stuck on the number 50, but that would just be a manageable small village, totally interconnected with thousands of other manageable small villages. So just I'll end there for now, but just to make clear that I'm looking at a very great impending depression. I'm also looking at a scenario maybe a few years beyond that where the infrastructure completely breaks down because of the ecological disasters that are unfolding before our eyes. So it's good to be prepared, and then if you don't need it, fine. But if we're unprepared, we're not going to survive. You were talking about community, and you got through to me in such a way as to make me wonder, well, what would a good community look like? And that's what I'm working on. I'm going to outline it. I have to define it before I can acquire it, because that's what I mean.
A community could look like anything you want it to look like if you design it that way. You don't have to follow any pattern as such in how to design a community. It's just essentially you work off of the basic premise that a group of people sharing many things in common could come together and live together in an orderly way, if setting the rules for themselves, determining how they want to live themselves. That's a community. Thanks for calling in. Patricia from New York, you're on the air. How are you?
Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay, good afternoon, Yatrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family. I'm doing fairly well today.
Great.
I wanted to talk about Eric Garner and Pantaleo and him being suspended. As you remember, he was suspended by the administrative judge about 2 weeks ago. And the first thing that I scoured all the information that I could find to see if he was suspended with or without pay, and I just could not find that information. And I'm going to email my city council person and ask him, was he suspended with pay? But more than that, if you remember, chokeholds in New York City were banned. It was banned in 1993. And after Eric Garner was killed in 2014, the New York City use of force policy was amended about maybe 2 years later, about around 2016, to remove the ban on chokeholds. Now, the chokehold is what killed Eric Garner, and of course, the police union said that, in fact, it wasn't a chokehold, but it was a seatbelt restraint that was used. But in any event, it has now been banned, and the policy now says that chokeholds can be used if a panel of police officers, and they're called the Use of Force Review Board, says that it's okay. And then they also deleted a provision that says deadly force has to be used as a last resort. So what you now have in New York City after the killing of Eric Garner is that the use of force policy in New York is one of the least progressive in the city, which is supposed to be a very progressive city. And this not only has occurred under the de Blasio administration, but we see de Blasio last week in the debate talk about the fact that the family was going to receive justice, really attempting to distance himself from any responsibility for what has transpired since Eric Garner was killed. So I think I'm trying to say that, you know, justice is not only about holding Pantaleo accountable, it's making sure that deaths at the hands of police by chokeholds don't happen again. But it seems that now it is more likely that chokeholds can be used, will be used, and not only will it be used, but it can be defended. So it's more likely and not less likely that someone can now die at the hands of the police who use a chokehold. And I haven't heard anybody talk about this at all.
Well, what is really at stake here is the unwillingness to tackle what I think is, you raise a good point about the chokehold. But we really have to understand what happened in this case. This whole case was removed from a court of law. And the police department became the court of law. I don't know how that was allowed. And we had all kinds of exemptions being made in the course of this trial. You have a case that was essentially a homicide being treated as an administrative issue. I don't know how they did that. And we certainly deserve it. This case is, as far as I'm concerned, is not finished at all. And it raises serious questions. You have an officer who is implicated, and we saw it on videotape, in the death of a citizen. And we saw him tackle him from the back and put his arm across his throat, Eric Garner's throat, sorry, brought him down, and we heard, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and nobody was particularly perturbed. Nobody saw to Eric Garner's life and the possibility that he was in trouble. And we have several, not just Pantaleo, you have several other officers who were directly involved, and they should have been prosecuted because they did nothing to save Eric Garner's life. You have the ambulance people who showed up and couldn't be more lackadaisical about a man who was dying. They haven't been charged with any crime. But I'm talking about what eventually happened to this case. This case was made to avoid a court of law where everything would be out in the open. A jury would be put together and the case would be prosecuted like any other case in which you have a homicide occurring. It didn't happen. We didn't have the federal government, and this was one of the things that Eric Holder had promised to do, and that this is after the Ferguson case with Michael Brown. He swore by everything holy, the Justice Department will intervene and surely will deliver justice. It didn't happen with Michael Brown. it didn't happen with Eric Garner. So I'm waiting to see why the question hasn't been asked. The authority has been given back to the police department. The commissioner of the of police becomes the chief judge. I mean, how does that happen? And even after this homicide, the chief suspect in the homicide is given a raise to $120,000 a year. This is blatant obstruction of justice and a violation of Eric Garner's rights and the people's rights. So they handpicked the administrative judge. What is this administrative judge? Why do you have to have an administrative judge in a case so clear on which the charges should clearly be homicide or manslaughter at the very least? But the pathologist, the medical examiner, ruled it a homicide. So why is it in an administrative court? As if Pantaleo broke an administrative procedure. This is insane. And I think people have to insist that this case be reviewed, and the people who are part of these coalitions or oversight committees and so forth, this is something that the city council should pick up. The city council should demand a review or should conduct its own review of this case. It has the authority to do so. But as we know, the police unions have tremendous influence. The mayor has stepped back from the case, attempting to make people believe, well, justice has been done. And all the while, nothing of the sort is true. But you raise a very good point here about chokeholds. And they're calling it the seatbelt maneuver. It yeah. wasn't your basic standard chokehold. They're now calling it a seatbelt maneuver. But at the same time, it not only was Pantaleo that it took to subdue Eric Garner, because he was fighting for his life, but all the rest of the gang that was with Garner are responsible and should have been charged also with Garner's death. And they haven't been. Thanks, Patricia. Good to hear from you.
Thanks.
Matt, you're on the air.
Yes, greetings, beloved family. I want to speak on this Pantaleo situation, and next week I'll get into this situation. Can't even believe that the brother doesn't see a correlation with Trump's rhetoric, who actually doubled down and refuses to say that he'll tone it down, and he's actually saying his rhetoric brings unity. So we're in a real crazy situation. But Pantaleo, Patricia has it actually right. I first heard DeRay McKesson of Black Lives Matter, MSNBC had him on the other week, and he broke that down exactly what Patricia explained about how they changed the definition and given the chokehold a pass now, essentially. And Utrecht, you're absolutely right. The three other officers, they not only did not help him, but they actually participated in holding him down on the ground. what's his name, de Blasio, actually came out and called himself, well, we have to hold hands and everything. But if we're holding hands, that means that the primary question that nobody's talking about is the whole idea that he would be arrested. First of all, he wasn't selling cigarettes at that point. You can even see that in the video. Why would you say you need to shut down Rikers? That's a nightmare. We know what happened to the brother who committed suicide after being held there in solitary confinement, Browder. You know, the young brother. So why would you say you need to shut down Rikers, but you go into, you can go up and down the street and all the bodegas, all the Yemeni and Bangladeshi and, you know, all those stores, they all sell Lucy's. No police would ever go in there and arrest somebody versus giving them a ticket. It doesn't make sense. Nobody's questioning this idea, and that's how they actually spun this whole idea. Well, Patrick Lynch, in terms of his craziness, we need to make an arrest. Why would you arrest somebody for a misdemeanor? He's a middle-aged man. He's got health problems that a lot of black people, as Clara was saying, do. And you justify that? That just makes no sense. That just shows that we're still operating on some level of slavery. And what you call the union, that's the lynch mob support picnic squad. Okay, because they're not a union. They justify the most atrocious treatments. I mean, it doesn't make sense that you say you're entitled to arrest someone, even if he had been selling cigarettes. And by the way, the daughter said that she got no personal effects back, and that's because he probably didn't have any cigarettes. His spot was at the Staten Island Ferry. Never, ever should have been arrested. It just makes no sense on any level whatsoever. And, of course, the hate squad, the lynch squad, is evidence in that after Garner was dead, Pantaleo had the temerity and the hostility to charge him with a felony, and he just made up that he had, he imagined that he had 40,000 cartons or some such ridiculous. That situation about the felony charge that he put on Brother Garner after he was dead of having thousands of cartons of cigarettes, that there shows what the hostility and lynching squad mentality was, you know. And I'm waiting for somebody to say, particularly de Blasio, why was he arrested for something that at most should have been a ticket? Now, the main situation, as a sister brought out who talked to Eric's father, was that Eric had gone to internal affairs and he had made a complaint because Pantaleo and his team of thugs were actually taking his monies, okay? So that's what the whole crazy arrest and everything was about. It's good when people can call in, like on this program, because the sister said, the father said about the complaint. That's what it was about, because they were taking his money. It was a constant shakedown. Okay? And lastly, let me just...
But how do we have a mayor and a city council not questioning this whole judicial process? How is it that, in effect, a police officer implicated in the murder of a citizen of the city gets to have an administrative hearing on such a serious charge? You have an administrative hearing if you're, you know,
reckless in storing your gun or something, according to the workbook.
I understand what you're saying, but keep in mind, when the Obama, Holder and Lynch, they sat on it for 2 years. The Office of Civil Rights, the Korea people under Trump, wanted to move forward, of course, with just the one action against Pantaleo and not identifying the other actors in the whole scenario. And you basically have a situation where we actually exist in an unemancipated state, because any time that you wouldn't take this before a jury, whether it's first of all the state jury, and then if that doesn't happen or is unsuccessful, and then the civil rights jury, this whole idea under the corrupt Barr, who nicks what the Civil Rights Division wanted to do, at least against Pantaleo, is makes no sense. No other prosecutor in the land starts out saying, "Oh, we can't win that." That's just an excuse.
First time they did this. Said the very same thing in Ferguson, Missouri.
Yes. Yes, so that's
this is
pattern.
This is the great, and of course, we had Eric Holder. I was the only one in the room, or the only reporter allowed in the room, and in the killing of Amadou Diallo, the kind of pressure that had to be brought for the government to do its job. And even when they did the job, look what happened. Look how they did it. The outcome was predictable.
And it's always the same. So it's, and if you actually go to the civil rights laws under this would cover, and I studied with the Moors at some point in the mid-90s, and when you go to Title 18, 241, 242, you could not have had a better written law in terms of people could actually be subject to the death penalty. And they talk about it, the scenario, as if a highway robbery in one aspect of the law. It's written very well, and what they did at some point was just make up this idea that it doesn't fit the bar. That does not conform to what the letter and the spirit of the law actually says. Title 18,
we know 241
to 42.
The unfortunate thing is that people haven't gotten behind these cases in numbers that are impressive enough to let the system know, we know your tricks. We
you know
your tricks.
And it gives me an idea that as we talk about reparations and develop that language, equally important is a truth and reconciliation commission. Because anytime you have the police departments with the prosecutors and the federal prosecutors too, you have a situation that you literally will never unwound. I mean, how do you have so-called unions that actually are promoters of the most heinous, brutish, slave patrolling equipment and procedures? It just goes on. Now look at what Preet Bharara, now he's their dream boy. He wrote a book recently called Doing Justice, whatever, with Mamali Graham, who police were allowed, we don't have castles, they were allowed to break down his door, go into his bathroom, and somehow claim he had marijuana and shoot him point blank. So the brother's comments about the Second Amendment yesterday, or actually I might have heard it on phone archives, it just does not jive. So Preet Bharara, he actually issued a press release as to why. That's instead of doing the federal civil rights prosecution, he issued a press release on the situation with Marley Graham. So if we don't have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission where you could actually just unravel the whole of injustices as to how the whole police departments and their so-called unions operate, I mean, it just makes no sense. All the bodegas, the Yemeni, et cetera, stores, and you know, they're good people there, but they all sell Lucy's. Now, sometimes they might target them, but you would give a ticket, and that's
bad
enough.
But in any event, the penalty for selling loose cigarettes, allegedly, is not
death. Yes, allegedly, yes, and it gets to the complaint.
It's as simple as that. We need to start right there. The penalty, if there is to be one, is not death.
It cannot be death, and it cannot be arrest, because if somebody like Eric Gardner winds up in Rikers, which you admit is something you need to shut down, that's a form of death in itself. I mean, the statistics in terms of when people have health crises, et cetera, et cetera.
We're talking, but we're not doing. This is the problem. A lot of talk, but they know the community is not going to take action to receive justice. And the community in turn knows it cannot expect justice. This is the conundrum.
And that's why
everybody knows that this is wrong. Everybody knows that Eric Garner was murdered. And everybody knows that what the outcome would be, strongly predicting what the outcome will be, and they were proven right. And this is a consistent pattern. And funny, nobody could see it. Not even the Department of Justice, not even Eric Holder, not Barack Obama. Nobody could see the pattern that these cases follow. Nobody could see it.
Yeah, and look at what happened in Chicago.
We have to move on. I don't want to cut you short, but we have a bunch of people still hanging in here who want to talk. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air.
Hello, wonderful Eugene.
Hey, wonderful Harvey. What's going on by you?
Well, by fostering fear and hatred against different groups of people, President Trump has opened the door to murder and mayhem in America, just like Hitler did in Germany. And in a sense, he's encouraged pathogenic means deadly, pathogenic types of people to kill innocent people. We know how easy it is to get for these pathogenic people to have access to guns. And classically, the president's job has been to protect us from those who would put us in harm's way. But Trump has done just the opposite. His divide-and-conquer rhetoric has opened the door to murder. Being that fear is the prime motivator, President Trump has used his power to create a state of fear, which is leading to many American people self-incarcerating. It turns out that in terms of the economy, people will think twice about going to the mall to shop, which is bad for retail shopping, and it'll suffer. It'll drive shoppers more online, where they can shop from their house, and put a lot of jobs in jeopardy. So he's ruining a lot of people's form of employment. People are worried about taking their families to festivals, like here in California, we had the garlic festival, the Kilroy Garlic Festival. That town is still in a state of shock, and it's going to take a long time for anything to happen. So what little joy we have in our society in getting together in public places is being ruined by President Trump and his hate speech rants. Parents are afraid to send their kids to school because of school shootings. Places of worship are targets for shooters. President Trump has brought America, has brought war to America. That's what he's done.
I can't disagree at all with what you've just said. This is, but do you think enough people are listening and taking heed to what people are saying, that we are in perilous times?
Well, as people as people lose their jobs because people are afraid to go out, it's going to change the economy. It's not just about people being murdered, innocent people being murdered. It's going to really put a drag on our economy and hurt it in a lot of major ways, especially on the retail level. And it'll, people will be afraid to go out. This will lead to more kind of mental illness, a kind of a fear of each other. He's really the worst possible type of president that we could have.
Thanks, Harvey, for your commentary today.
Thank you.
Willie from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hello, beloved. Good afternoon to the family. Listen,
thank you.
I don't know what to say, but, you know, everybody's blaming Trump, you know. It's bigger than Trump. You see what I'm saying? Because, you know, you had to have a Trump. And America had to behave the way it did. The whole world is seeing this now and seeing what's happening to black people and brown people and how they're treating us. When you're ripping babies from their mothers without any regard, you know, for the child and do the things you're doing, I mean, that is satanic. And this had to happen. Because if it didn't happen, that would have made Minister Farrakhan irrelevant. Because everything he has said, we are now seeing it. You even yourself are saying it yourself. It's about survival. And he's been saying that for 64 years, that we have to set up, just like the Amish people, we have to do for self what we must do for ourselves, for our survival. So what we're saying now, in my judgment, it will only force us to unite together and organize. Kwame Ture has always, in every speech, he has always said, organize, organize, organize. And that is something we have refused to do. We're looking to the Democratic Party, and we're looking to we've tried that from so many years, still hasn't worked. Why? Because it's the same very party. We have to do for ourselves. And you're now saying it and seeing it. So,
I've been saying this for years. This is one of my themes for decades, in fact. I've talked about it. The idea of reclaiming our communities and reinvesting in our communities as a principal way of providing for our survival. And its survival isn't just about you have enough food and you have enough clothes and you have a car, but survival being that people return to a purposeful way of living. And this is something that I've been talking about for years.
Yeah, hello?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if you saw that speech between when before Trump got elected. The minister said, "If you Hillary is a very wicked woman, and it's like electing selecting Satan over Lucifer," and his exact words were, "If Trump get elected, he's going to take us to hell in a rocket ship. And the whole world is in turmoil now based on what that administration." So So he only validates our brother. So these things have to.
Well, they're all different kinds of interpretations. All I'm asking, I'm still asking the point that we're talking too much. We're not doing enough. We're just talking. And this is one of the things that the enemies of the people know, that we'll talk and talk and talk, but we won't do anything.
But that is not true, though, you trees.
Okay, show me where we talked, but we also did. And
but that's not true, because the Nation of Islam is doing for ourselves and our community.
Well, but the Nation of Islam is a religious organization, and they're doing their thing in accordance with their philosophy and so forth. But the Nation of Islam is not the whole nation. The rest of the nation, where are we? We're still talking. We're not serious. We're not committed. We're just talking. I could show you several communities across the nation that came to a point in which they decided our survival, our collective survival, is a number one priority. And guess what? They may not have been perfect, but they came to that realization and they worked on it. And they're still doing quite well as communities. They're not bothering anybody. They're growing their own food. They built their own schools. They have health clinics and so forth. But that they put their thoughts and beliefs to work. But generally speaking, people talk, but they don't do anything. It's a source of frustration. And then you look at the communities, they have been shredded. You take a look at Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. All these communities that were once black communities and thriving, they either are on the brink of total destruction, or they already have been destroyed with a new plan being implemented. But they lost it. Because they just talked. Nobody is going to take them seriously. We just finished talking about Eric Garner. This system knows that black people in New York City are not serious about their interests and will mobilize to protect their interests. They know that. So they play the community like a fiddle. You don't have power. You don't amass the power that you have and work with it. You don't build. You don't invest. So you contribute to the vulnerability of your community. You know, so this is the dilemma that we have. The Nation of Islam can't solve Black America's problems. It can't. It could provide an example of what is possible. It could marshal its own resources that its membership might have to engage in community building, but they can't provide the answer. They don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the manpower. And in fact, it is unfair to say that it is now we're going to look to them to solve the problem. No. We look to ourselves. We look to ourselves to solve our problems. So
that model, we organize with them. and support them financially.
No, this is what they are doing, and that's fine. We don't have to. We have the power, we have the wherewithal, we have the capability of solving our problems. So why wouldn't we just get serious about it? We keep looking for saviors everywhere. You come in and you do this. You come in and you do that. You know, I used to volunteer. I still do. And in one project, which I had in Brooklyn, I worked with the children. The children were phenomenal. No problems at all. None. And then at the end of the project, I ran their stories. I took pictures of the class and everything else and printed extra papers so that their parents could get them, and everything went well. I was leaving the school when the principal said to me, "Oh, I'm just so proud of this project because, you know, these are our slow children." I wanted to hit this woman squarely in the nose. They were not at all slow to me. They did everything I asked them to do. And they did it very well. They met their deadlines. They did their homework. And the principal is telling me, when the evidence is clear that this was a group of high-performing students, they perhaps were not motivated by their underperforming teachers, that I was in fact dealing with the slow group. This is what I mean. So every day that these children go into that school, a black teacher who is the principal is dumbing them down and doing very little to elevate them, and yet these kids are ready. They are ready to perform. We have serious contradictions in our community, and we can't look to other people to help us solve them. We have to get serious and solve them ourselves. And that brings us to the end of our program today. We still have people who might be calling in next week. We will try our best to get you in. But I'm so glad to have you and to be in your midst, because you really bring a refreshing dimension to our regular daily lives. This is the weekend. Surround yourselves with people who bring positive dimension to your life. Take it easy, and we'll see each other Monday. Bye-bye. Don't think that we're too happy in this world of material.